session number 28776, reel 18.
Admiral Sir Raymond Ligo, reel 18.
Right, so that was the environment in which we found ourselves. Now, the Air Force assumption was that if they could win this argument, I'm making this assumption because I wasn't. If they could win the argument and the carrier program was destroyed or nullified, then all that money would be available to buy things which they thought would enhance the value of the Royal Air Force, and of course, whether they believed it or not, would enable them to provide the Navy from shore bases with all the defence that they required. Now, the concept that they pursued was, in our view, ludicrous. I mean, in order to... what did they have to do? First of all, we had to create a scenario, what the scientists did, of the Navy convoying some body or something at some stage in the future, way out to sea, and the enemy with the capability of attacking. Funnily enough, not so much from the air, as it turned out in the end, but from long-range surface-to-surface missiles. But nevertheless, we were required by the scenarios to be defended. Now, to provide a fighter defense over the fleet, which was 400 or 500 miles out to sea, required the Air Force, and it was assumed they were going to get the Phantom, as we were, required those Phantoms to be on station for 1 hour or an hour and a half, or 2 hours even, and then they got to get there, and then they got to get back. So they were actually flying 7 hour sorties. And quite frankly, I thought, as a fighter pilot, that this was ludicrous. But oh no, the Air Force said, no, it's perfectly possible. And one of the first difficulties that we faced, quite frankly, was that because all these chaps dressed up as Commodores in light blue uniform were on one side, and this dark blue uniform chap was on the other side, who was essentially Navy, who was the scientist to believe? The Air Force chaps, who were the experts? Or this dressed up naval chap who thought he knew everything? And then you might say, well, the Air Force must be right. So it was a very, very difficult situation. But it was made more difficult, really, by the fact, as I've said earlier, that the Navy wasn't behind us. As a result, George Baldwin, my boss, got very disillusioned by the whole process. Because he frankly thought there was a large section of the Navy that was quite prepared to give the whole fleet their arm away. And indeed, I think he was right. Now, I was so young and fresh that perhaps that didn't dawn on me, because I was the one that was thrown into battle at every stage. Now, one of the first mistakes I made, and I made it quite innocently, was when I was asked about, now, what is the normal operating pattern for carriers at sea? And I said, well, in the Pacific, which was the biggest example we had of mass carrier operations, it was 3 days up operating, 2 days back replenishing and repairing, then 3 days... Oh, they said, so you were only available for 3 days out of five. Now, before I could say anything, that was all written down as a golden rule. And the Air Force was then able to say, ah, but you see, we will be able to provide continuous cover. Now, what I should have said, well, a carrier is entirely flexible. It can be continuously on operation at a lower rate of strike, or it can be maximum strike, 3 days and then 2 days replenishment and then 3 days back in. But, you know, it was all written down in the tablets of stone. So, I was naive, to be honest with you. But then, from a position of incredibility that anybody could actually believe that, you know, it was more flexible to do these things from a shore base. Anyway, the battle progressed, and we also had a difficulty, which was a personal one, in that in those days we had a fifth Sea Lord who was head of naval aviation, and this was and he did not get on with George Baldwin. And they were both aviators, and it was, and you know. And as a result, because George stayed in London during the week, he had a flat or a pied a terre, and then because of that, liked to go home fairly early on a Friday and come in fairly late on a Monday. We had a routine that I would cover Friday evenings and early Monday mornings, because I was there. I was commuting in from Kent. And so that was the arrangement we had. But it didn't occur to me that George was not really getting on terribly well with his boss, which was a Fasilo. And it came to a head. I mean, the battle progressed, and it went on and on and on. And one of the problems which we had, a major problem, was that the Air Force team was led by the Assistant Chief of the Air Staff Operations, who was, because he came to work for me in British Airspace afterwards. I don't think he was very happy about that. But was this chap, Fletcher. And we had to put up against him the Assistant Chief of Naval Staff Operations, who was a fish head, a charming fish head, Michael Pollock, who subsequently became First Sea Lord. But Michael Pollock, what he knew about aviation, I mean, you could write on the back of a Tuppence stamp. And the hierarchical situation that we faced in the ministry was these two chaps would sit at the top of the table, either side of the scientist who was adjudicating, arguing the case. And LIGO was about four down the table between the Assistant Chief of the Naval Staff. There were civil servants and various people then. And some of the civil servants, in fact, quite a lot of them, particularly in the centre, were absolutely hostile to the Navy. Why? I suspect because a lot of them had to endure what was then known as the Zuckerbatten Axis, if you remember, which was the liaison between Zuckerman, who was the head scientist at the time, and Mountbatten, and it was known as the Zuckerbatten Axis, and that was in the centre, and they may have seen this as something they resented. Anyway, whatever it was, they were hostile, and it got to the point where, you know, it was very, very difficult, because here we were technically operating the Hermes up the Persian Gulf, hot and humid, with a Phantom, which meant that with the amount of fuel you could put in it to get it off and all the rest of it, it had something like 25 minutes on station. So it was effectively an off-the-deck interceptor. It wasn't a patrolling aircraft. And of course the Phantom at that time, and indeed eventually, was to have a Rolls-Royce engine. And this was the first time I had realized the enormous lobbying power of Rolls-Royce as a company, much more than British Aerospace or Westerns, whoever it was. You know, Rolls-Royce. And Rolls-Royce had a special director in the Ministry of Defense at that time, who was a civil servant known as Director Engines or something. And that was to keep Rolls-Royce funded. And they were funded to the tune of 40 or 50 million a year to carry on with their research, whereas the other aircraft companies were not, as far as I knew. And I was remote from this. Fortunately, I was remote from it, or I would never have been allowed to go and run British Airspace. But at any rate, the whole thing degenerated into a very, very difficult and nasty mess, with the Navy and the Air Force at each other's throats. And, as I say, It got to a point where, late one Friday, Frank Hopkins was the FitzSea Lord, I was trying to remember his name. It was late on a Friday, and I had a call, I was still there, I had a call from Frank Hopkins' office saying, would I come up? So I went, he was there in his office with the Navy Minister, who was the chap who became a Liberal, resigned over the issue. He was there, and they were having a drink. And so Frank Hopkins said, would you care for a drink? And I never really drank very much, but I thought I needed one this evening, so I had a small whiskey with him. And he said, well, Ray, we've just come from the Secretary of State, and we thought we'd lost the whole lot. But we've been given another month to come up with a better solution to our problem. Now, I had already been working on an alternative, which was that we would be able to manage the the three-carrier program with a much reduced expenditure. One was to cancel the new AEW aircraft and go on with the existing Gannett, to get rid of the Gannett fixed wing and just rely on helicopters. And also to man the three carriers with really 2.5 air groups, which would have put enormous strain on the crews, but it would have saved an awful lot of money. And after all, this was a political argument, not a military one. So I always hoped that you'd get away with it afterwards without having actually to do it. So he said, well, we've got another month. And I said, and I remember these words very well, I said, sir, we have to stop fighting this battle with one arm tied behind our back. And he said, what do you mean? And I said, well, the people leading our case are not aviators. And I remember very well, and I actually lifted up my hand, and I said, put the knife in my hand, sir, and I'll have their guts all over the carpet. And he said, right, tomorrow, on Monday morning, it's going to change, Ray. You'll be in charge, and we'll go for them. And I said, great, that's what we want to do. That's the only way we're going to succeed. At that point, the minister had to leave to go to another meeting through Frank Hopkins, and then left. I could hardly wait to ring George Baldwin at home to tell him that I'd had this meeting, and then on Monday morning he would be sent for by Frank Hopkins, and the whole way in which the campaign was going to be run would change. And DNAW, George and myself, would be in charge of it. So I thought, right, well, we've got a chance now. We've really got a chance. That call never came. He never called George Baldwin. Nothing happened, and nothing changed. You know, we sometimes enjoy, certainly it's rather comforting to have nice people as your seniors. In times of stress, you need a competent, nasty bastard. You don't need somebody who's terribly couth and wears a satin tie. You don't need that. You'll lose if you do, as sure as eggs are eggs. And we did. I came up with an alternative strategy. Healy had said, I can see the case for four carriers, I can't understand the case for three. So I came up with a program for four carriers. We were going to run Ark Royal on. We were going to run, you know, all technically theoretical stuff. Ian Easton, by this time, had arrived as what was then called Director of Staff Duties or something, DTDSD, which was quite an important post in arguing the case, along with the Director of Plans, etc. Anyway, he then, this was a story that I've never forgotten. He came to see me on arrival, and he's an old friend of mine. We'd been together in the war during an indefatigable. And he said, Ray, I'd like to show you this letter that I've had from the chap I'm relieving before I arrived here. And this was Terence Terry Lewin. And he said, and the letter was unbelievable, from Terry Lewin to Ian it was, well, welcome to your new job, dear. I have got CVA 01. It's your job to get CVA 02. And I said to Ian, this is unbelievable. We've already lost CVA 01. It's not been announced, but, you know, we're in a death struggle and we're losing. And this man is telling you he's got it. I mean, it's just not credible. And I realized, of course, once again, that some people are inclined to say what they would like to have happened rather than what would happen. People have been in the press recently and in trouble for saying all politicians have to lie if they're to be successful. Well, it doesn't apply only to old politicians. It can also apply, as I'm sorry to say, they've lost us as well. But that was the basis on which I created a four-carrier fleet. I remember going into the First Sea Lord's office and his rather creepy secretary was there. I never trusted the bugger. And he said to me, well, Ray, you'll be guaranteed to get an OB or something of this kind. I don't really give a bugger about the OBE. All I want to do is make sure we still have a Navy. We didn't have a Navy. We lost the battle. And despite the fact that I'd created a possible plan over one weekend for a four-carrier fleet, the Board of Admiralty went down the corridor to present the old three-carrier fleet to the Secretary of State once again. He'd already said that he didn't understand that and didn't want it. Unbelievable. They went down like a bunch of bloody sheep. And at the debrief, I remember the First Sea Lord, who was an awfully nice man. Here we go again. Debriefing us. The room was full of senior chaps, and I was right at the back as a junior captain. And he said, well, we had the meeting. It's essentially about the Buccaneer 2-star and whether that would satisfy the Air Force's requirements, you see. Instead of having to go for an F-111, which they had been offered by the Secretary of State. And it was going very well in our favour until the Chief of the Air Staff made this statement. He said that, without having to tell us exactly what, the Air Force had certain very secret acts which they had to carry out. And a lot of these were sort of photographic reconnaissance. And the F-111 was the only aircraft that could accommodate a camera of the correct focal length. Now, I just couldn't believe this when he said this. He was swinging his glasses round. He had this habit. And I shouted from the back of the room, prisms, sir, prisms. And everybody looked round like, who is this bloody man like at the back? And he went on to say, well, of course, I couldn't argue with the Chief of the Air Staff. I mean, he had made his statement. Can you believe it? It was absolute crap. And yet, they got away with it. And they got away with the whole thing. And we were then left with picking up the pieces. And they weren't very happy pieces. Park Royal was to be modernised to carry her on for a bit. Eagle was to be paid off, although she was the most advanced carrier with 984 CDS. And we were going to be left with Ark Royal and a few bits and pieces, mostly in the role of commando carriers, Albion, Bulwark, Centaur, not Centaur, Centaur was to be paid off. Victorious had already, they could hardly wait. And when the announcement was made, the tragic thing was how quickly these ships were taken to the scrapyard. Almost as if we want to remove the evidence. It was like that. A very, very painful period and time for aviators in the Navy. However, there it was. We had to get on with it, and we did. And one of the things we were left with was an ASW role. And we needed a new helicopter for that. And so, oh yes, 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 as a kind of sop to the Navy, you can have a new helicopter. And of course, up came Westerns ably supported by the Ministry of Aviation, or whatever it was called then, who said, right, we need a new, and it was to be called NAST, Naval Air Staff Target 358, a new helicopter, big helicopter. And I thought, crikey, with Weston's reputation at building helicopters at that time, I think we're standing into danger.
Could I just ask what that reputation was?
Well, it wasn't. It was known in the trade as the agricultural machinery manufacturers of the West Country, because that's what they were essentially. So it just so happened that at this time, one of my staff officers came to see me, Hefford, and he said, "There's an exchange pilot, sir, who's just come back from the United States Navy, where he's been flying the Sea King helicopter. Would you like to see him?" And I said, of course I would, remembering that when I came back from my exchange duty flying Phantoms, with more jet experience than anybody else in the Royal Navy, nobody had asked to see me at all. So in came this chap, I can't remember his name now, and he sat down and thought, and I said, "Where have you been operating?" "Oh, out of Key West." I said, "Oh." I said, "It's a great pity that the Sea King can't carry the Wessex 3's payload." He said, "How do you mean, sir?" And I said, "Well, I've been told it hasn't got the lift capability, and it wouldn't have the endurance." He said, "But, sir, I've just been flying 4.5 hour sorties out of Key West in Sea King helicopters, and there's no problem at all." I said, "Well, no, you can't be right, because I've been told by the ministry that..." He said, "Well, would you like to see the pilot's notes?" And he got a copy of the pilot's notes. He would. I looked at these and I said, "That bastards. They had determined to provide Westerns with a new program. They have totally distorted the capability of this aircraft. And what they'd done is they'd taken all the lowest parameters and given them, rather than given the best parameters, the average parameters." So I thought, right, I saw George Baldwin, I said, "I'm going to have to go to the States and I'm going to have to see what we can get." I went to the States. I was followed all the way by a nice chap from Westland, trying to find out what I was up to the whole time I was there. I went to the ministry, I went to, of course, Washington, to British Naval Staff, and then I went on an organized program to Bell, where I flew the Huey. I went to Boeing, where I flew the Chinook, and the smaller one, I think it's called a 107 or something, a smaller one. And then I went to Sikorsky and flew the Sea King, or the SH-3 C or D, it was then called, I think. And of course, the great thing about the Sea King was it already had a hover coupler. In the other aircraft, we'd have had to go through all the programs. And they all, of course, all the manifest, "Oh, this is very easy, very simple." But I didn't believe that. What I did believe, that what the Sea King had, was a hover coupler already there. And it was a perfectly straightforward aircraft. So, as I said to you, I sat next to your Sikorsky at lunch on my visit there, and I came back and said, right, that's the aircraft we're going to go for. The total cost of the R&D was $50 million to convert it and bring it, put the Wessex 3 system into it. I then said to Weston, if you're going to have this aeroplane, you're not to muck about with it. It is to be built to US Navy standards. We're not having you anglicise it, because that'll destroy it. It must be produced exactly to Sikorsky's drawings. So that was the condition we made. And I then said to them, I was trying to remember his name the other day, and it came to me when I was telling this story to somebody. Hislop, Charles Hislop, was the technical director. And I said to him, Charles, if you go for this aeroplane and build it, it'll be the best thing that's ever happened to Westland. And of course it was. They must have made a fortune out of it. I didn't get any money myself, but they must have made, or somebody must have made, a lot of money. But that was Weston's, and that was the story of the helicopter and how that aircraft entered the Navy. It was solely down to my going there and finding out by talking to that exchange pilot that what I was being told in the Ministry of Defence was a load of rubbish. And this is one of the problems of the Ministry of Defence, as I discovered when I got into British aircraft, you know, British aerospace. By the time the messages got to wherever they were supposed to be received, you know, they were just somewhat distorted, I'm bound to say. Very, very difficult.
Can you give me some of the characteristics of the Sea King that you thought made it such a good helicopter?
Yes, well, first of all, it was easier to fly. I mean, you could see there, you could see where you were going. You were up front, it was a lovely airplane. You could, well, perhaps I shouldn't say this, but I am a helicopter pilot. It flew like a fixed-wing aircraft. You could fly it on and land it, you could take off. It was easy to fly. It was designed to hover, so that when you dunked your sonar, there was the aeroplane sitting there steady, not mucking about on any kind of dark night, horrible conditions. There it was. It had been designed to do this. It did it. It had enormous flexibility. It wasn't a great big helicopter like a Chinook. It wasn't a tiny little aeroplane. It wasn't much bigger than a Huey, really. But it was well designed, well developed. Well, yes, it was just a good helicopter. And of all ones I flew, mind you, they all flew very nicely, I'm bound to tell you. But this one had a hover coupler. That was a great thing. And it could do all the things we wanted it to do without us having to pay some clever Englishman who'd never done it to do it for us.
Because you also mentioned that you stated to Westlands not to anglicise it in many ways.
That's right.
What types of things would they have done to
it? Well, you see, one of the things that they would have done, and they did, with the Wessex 1, was they would say, oh, well, we don't have that type of aluminium in this country, it was specified. And so you went for the next specification up. Instead of buying what you wanted in from America and putting it in the aeroplane, now you'd immediately started making it heavier. And then you said, oh, we can't do that, we can do this. We can't do that, we can't do either. And it was, or we'll put a different engine in. Oh, forget it. Forget it. It's going to cost a fortune and won't be as good. This aeroplane, at that time, had already been in service with the United States Navy for a considerable time. It wasn't a brand new aeroplane, it was a well-tried airframe-engine combination. And it worked. So why not go for it? Same as with the Phantom. With the Phantom, we insisted on putting the Rolls-Royce engine into it. Now, in the middle of the Air Defence Review, and the Defence Review under Healy, suddenly the RAF said, we don't need the Rolls-Royce engine in the Phantom. We can live with the J-39, whatever it was. So I was suddenly faced one morning with the fact that the Air Force was going to bail out of this program, and the whole cost of putting the Spey into the Phantom was going to fall on the Navy. So I worked out the sums on Hermes and the Gulf, and the difference between the alleged performance of the RAF, of the Rolls-Royce engine, and the Westinghouse engine was 3 or 4 minutes. So I said, we don't need it either. We'll have the standard American engine. Frank Hopkins went to lunch that day with the head of the procurement agency in the Ministry of Defence, whatever it was called that day, came back the same for me and said, Ray, what have you been saying about this Rolls-Royce engine? I said, I've said we don't need it, sir. He said, why? I said, because the Air Force has said they don't need it. And if they don't need it, and we say we need it, the whole cost of that program falls on the naval variant. And we don't need it, and I can show you that we don't need it. So he said, well, I've been told by this chap, call your dogs off. Because we want that engine to go into the Phantom, the Spey, and we're determined to have it. That was the Ministry of Defence. So we paid an awful lot of money for Rolls-Royce to put the Spey into the Phantom. They also claimed, of course, at that time that the aircraft would be able to go at 2.3 or something like that. Never did. Never did. And when I talked to Rolls-Royce about this in later life, I was told by, what was his nice chap who ran it, that he used my comments as a casebook study for never try to defeat, you know, be careful how you tell your lies to the Ministry of Defence, because there may be somebody like LIGO there who will catch you up. And we did. But that was yet another saga in, and the power of Rolls-Royce at that time. Make no mistake.